fact. The second fact is the United States is radioactive politically in the Middle East and in most of the global South. I would say about 80% of the population of the entire world wants nothing to do with Joe Biden or his amateur, you know, State Department and Defense Department leaders. And even the Defense Department in the U.S. is hesitant to get into any kind of military interaction in Yemen, because they understand how difficult it is. So the Saudis understand this as well. They don't want to be sucked into some cockamamie American plan drawn up in some underground bunker in Iowa or Kansas. I don't know where these things are, where they come up with these incredible ideas. I'm old enough to remember the 1960s and 70s when I was in college, and until today, the U.S. has tried four or five times over the last 60 years that I've been a journalist to come up with coalitions of Israelis, Americans, and Arabs against some bad guy in the region. It could be Iraq, it could be Iran, it could be Qaeda, it could be Nasser, it could be the communists. It changes over time. Every time they've tried to do this, it doesn't work, because the people running American foreign policy do not have the fundamental decency or strategic knowledge to understand that you can't go into an Arab country where 90% of the people support the Palestinians and want the Palestinians to live peacefully with an Israeli state. We're not against an Israeli Jewish majority state, but it has to live with Palestinians peacefully. 90% of people across most of the region want Palestinian rights to be resolved, and they don't want 25 American bases all around the region, which is one reason people in Iraq are shooting at American bases in Iraq and Syria. And you can't get Arab governments to just run roughshod over their people and say, the hell with you, we're going to make an alliance with Israel, we're going to make an alliance with the U.S. They've learned the hard way that the populations in the Arab countries are not perpetually docile. We've had 10 years of uprisings from 2010 to 2020, and there's still things happening in many Arab countries. But there is no realistic way that you can get serious Arab governments to go into an alliance with the U.S. and Israel, whether it's to protect shipping or to do anything else. The way you protect shipping in the Red Sea is you stop the assault on Gaza. That's what the Yemenis have made clear. They're only doing this. They're only firing at Israeli-linked ships because of what Israel's doing in Gaza. They said, stop the assault, the genocide on Gaza. We'll stop shooting. It's in Yemen's interest to have the ships come and go. So these are fundamental common sense elements of foreign policy, which for some odd reason do not pertain in Washington. Washington doesn't know how, broadly speaking, doesn't know how to engage in foreign policy. They use their warfare capabilities, they use sanctions, they veto stuff at the UN, they make threats, they try to come up with these grandiose coalitions, and most of these have failed since Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, today. They don't work, and they keep trying them. It's very puzzling. This is really one of the great puzzles that American political scientists and psychiatrists need to study. Why does the U.S. refuse to see realities around the world until they're defeated and they get out and then they, you know, negotiate with the Viet Cong, they negotiate with the Taliban, and they'll negotiate with Hamas as they negotiated with Arafat and the PLO. You're going to see American officials sitting with Hamas, I would say 6-8 months down the road probably. They start quietly meeting in cafes in Vienna and stuff. And then, so there's something about American foreign policy that's formulated in the public sphere that is both irrational and ineffective. And it's largely because the people doing it do not understand how the world works and respond to political, financial, electoral pressures in their own constituencies. The political leaderships in the U.S. Are highly deficient in conducting a moral foreign policy, but they're highly efficient at conducting a profitable mercantile electoral policy where they get votes, where they get support for advertising, where they get favorable media. And this is a tragedy for the United States, which tries to tell the world that it is for human rights and decency, equal rights. And the world believed this for 30, 40, 50 years, but doesn't believe it anymore. And Gaza is the kind of the exclamation mark on this, where the U.S. actively supports this genocide, will not do a ceasefire, and therefore this is the consequence, and the Saudis don't want anything to do with this.
Rami Khoury, I want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. We'll link to your piece in Al Jazeera, headlined Watching the Watchdogs, Why the West Misinterprets Middle East Power Shifts, speaking to us from Boston. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll go to James Bamford, who has a new piece in The Nation magazine, then a professor at Columbia University. And we'll hear from a student at Barnard talking about what's happening and censorship on college campuses. Stay with us.
This is my winter song to you. The storm is coming soon. It rolls in from the sea. My voice a beacon in the night. My words will be a light to carry you to me. Is love alive? 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 Just cannot grow beneath the winter snow, or so I have been told. They say we're buried far, just like a distant star.
Winter Song, performed by Leslie Odom Jr. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at what some are calling the Palestine exception to free speech and academic freedom on college campuses across the United States. Soon we'll hear from a student and professor at Barnard. But we begin with a new report by longtime investigative journalist James Bamford in a series for The Nation on Israel's spying and covert actions in the United States against pro-Palestinian students, supporters, and groups. Its headline, the latest piece, Who is Funding Canary Mission? Inside the doxing operation targeting anti-Zionist students and professors. Last month, Jim Bamford wrote a piece headlined Israel's War on American Student Activists. He's joining us now from Washington, D.C. James Bamford, welcome back to Democracy Now! Tell us what the Canary Mission is.
Well, it's a very massive program that's been going on for years and years. It's secretly run out of Israel, and the purpose is to blacklist and dox students, professors, and largely anybody that disagrees largely with Israel or is pro-Palestinian. Many, many people suddenly wake up and they find out people are calling them and saying, your name is on a blacklist, the Canary Mission blacklist. And you know, it's designed to intimidate these people, to get them to stop joining pro-Palestinian groups or to stop being activists and to comply with whatever the people behind Canary Mission wants. And that's basically to silence them. And the threat is that if you don't be silent, then, you know, your name's going to go on the blacklist. And if you go look for a job when you get out of when you graduate, or if you're trying to rise up in the professional ranks or a professorship, it's going to be blocked because your name's on this list, and it's almost impossible to get off the list. So that's just one of the many ways that the Israeli government has been pushing the American public basically to steer away from pro-Palestinian activism.
But how do you know that the Israeli government runs the Canary Mission, and why is it called the Canary Mission?
Well, I don't know why it's called Canary Mission. It has something to do with canaries in the mine or something
in the coal
like
mine.
That. Yeah, I guess so. The organization that runs it is very, very secret. The two of the organizations that looked into it was the Jewish Forward magazine and the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. And they determined that it was being run secretly from a place in Israel, a very secret place in Israel, and that there was a rabbi behind it. Tracing all these links back is very difficult, but that's where they traced it, to this these people in Israel that were basically running it. A lot of the funding comes from, and again, this is from Haaretz and also from the Forward. A lot of the funding comes from American wealthy Jewish Americans and Jewish American foundations, millions of dollars and so forth. So that's where a lot of the funding comes from. The Israeli government gets involved because they use Canary Mission as a tool. So if people are coming over from the United States, either Jewish or Palestinian, they're maybe going to visit families, they look at Canary Mission. They actually have it there, and they look at it, and they'll kick people out of Israel. They'll land at the airport, they'll be questioned, and they'll be questioned because their name is on Canary Mission, and then be deported, held in confinement for a couple of days or whatever, and then deported. That's happened numerous times to people. Again, they try keeping secret the fact that they're using Canary Mission, but a number of the professors and students who have been thrown out have seen that their name is on the guards at the airport, or the inspectors are checking their names off the Canary Mission list. So there's a heavy involvement of the Israeli government in this. It's run by mysterious Israelis, and it's funded by pro-Israeli money in the United States. So Israel has its fingers all over Canary Mission.
And James Bamford, could you talk about the reasoning and the context in which they created online profiles Canary Mission did for members of the Harvard Crimson's editorial board, a student newspaper?
Sure. Soon after October 7th, the attack, the student newspaper came out. Well, there were about 33 organizations that supported a statement basically saying, this all didn't start on October 7th. These activities have been going on for a long time. The fighting between Israel and Palestine, with the Palestinians obviously being on the losing side of the war against them by the Israelis. So they were basically saying that, look, it didn't just start on October 7th. Well, that created a storm of opposition. And almost immediately, almost all the people involved found themselves on Canary Mission, even people tangentially involved that happened to sign this this letter. So that's how it works. You know, you want to intimidate these people into not being an activist. Then you create this blacklist and doxing that tells where they are and who they are, and basically creates a dossier of them on this list. And so
Jim,
you don't want to get on the list.
That happen when the Harvard Crimson had an editorial supporting BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions?
Exactly, yeah. That's, it's not just at Harvard. It's schools all over the United States. And Harvard was one perfect example when they had that student letter come out and it was published in the Harvard Crimson. A lot of the people who were on that, who signed that letter, ended up on the blacklist for Canary Mission. So again, it's a tool for intimidation, and a lot of times it works.
And who are some of the prominent American donors who are involved in funding this effort?
Well, it was very difficult to find that because it's secret who. Donates money to the organization, largely secret. There was a mistake some group made on a tax form. And what that showed was at least one of the groups was the Diller family in California. They're one of the wealthiest families in California, billionaires. And they had donated $100,000 to the front organization of Canary Mission. It's a thing called Megamot Shalom. It's basically a front organization in Israel. And so what they did was they donated $100,000 through the Jewish Committee, Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco. And then from there, it went to another organization, the Central Fund for Israel, which is set up in New York. Because if they send the money directly to Israel, they don't get a tax advantage. So by sending it through this sort of front organization, the Central Fund for Israel or Central Fund of Israel in New York, then they get a tax advantage. And then the Central Fund of Israel just forwards the money to Megamot Shalom, the front organization for Canary Mission, and then it goes to Canary Mission. And again, this is very difficult to figure out because there's so many obstacles to trying to find out how the money actually goes from these wealthy individuals and organizations to this group in Israel.
You're saying the Canary Mission should have to sign up as a foreign agent?
Well, yeah, I'm saying that the people who are, first of all, this is a clandestine organization. It's very secretive. It's hidden behind a front company and or a front organization in Israel, and it's being used by the Israeli intelligence to find people that they could deny entry at the airport and deport and so forth. So this is an organization that's secret. It's being used by the Israeli government to the detriment of American citizens. So if you're contributing to it, you could be considered a contributing to a foreign entity, and you could be considered an agent of a foreign government. So those are issues that should be looked into. You know, I've been doing all these stories. I've talked to numerous FBI agents, and the FBI agents are fully in favor of actually taking cases. The problem is once they try to bring these cases up the channels to the Justice Department, nothing ever happens.
Well, so, Jim, we're
no
going to
matter what it is.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're going to be speaking with a Barnard professor, but you do write about a Columbia University Law School professor, Catherine Franke, who at one time sat on the Academic Advisory Council Steering Committee of Jewish Voice for Peace. Upon her landing in Tel Aviv, you write, an official at the airport showed her what appeared to be her Canary Mission profile. After being held in detention for 14 hours, she was deported and informed that she would be permanently banned from Israel. Just one example. Jim Bamford, we want to thank you for being with us, investigative journalist well known for exposing National Security Agency, the CIA. New York Times has called him the nation's premier journalist on the subject of the NSA. The New Yorker called him the NSA's chief chronicler. We'll link to your series in The Nation, including the last one, Who is Funding Canary Mission? This is Democracy Now! Back with a Barnard professor in a moment. حلوة يا بلدي غنوة حلوة وغنوتين حلوة يا بلدي أملي دايما كان يا بلدي إني أرجع عليك يا بلدي وأفضل دايما جنبك على طول وذكريات كل اللي فات فاكرة Come on. Denise Lebby here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're going to a Barnard professor, but we just learned that we're joined now, if we can reach him, by Akram El-Satari, a Gaza-based journalist, talking to us from Rafah in southern Gaza. It's so hard to get him that we want to go directly to him if, in fact, he's on the line. Akram, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Thank you so much for being with us. Can you just tell us what's happening right now in Rafah and in southern Gaza?
Well, it's extremely difficult to describe how difficult and fragile the situation in southern Gaza, Rafah and Khan Yunis area in particular. The area has been subjected to a complete shutdown of all communication system and a comprehensive jam of all communication, including the eSIMs that the Israeli authorities learned that the Palestinians using them to take and the truth to the world. The is heavier than every few seconds, a very heavy bombardment, very large destruction. I have just learned that the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, Al-Amal Hospital, Al-Amal means hope, Al-Amal Hospital was just hit. Around 22 people were killed because of that bombardment, and the Israeli occupation army is still bombarding the whole area. In Rafah, in Khan Yunis, in Deir al-Balah, in the Gaza central area, in Nusayrat, al-Maghazi, al-Burej, and also Juhr al-Dik area. So it's a very heavy, and it's a very heavy staying bombardment. 1 ton missiles, 2 ton missiles are hitting the houses and destroying whole blocks sometimes.
Can you how difficult, I can't imagine how difficult it is for you as a journalist working in Gaza to be able to report. Could you talk about some of the problems that you face?
Well, one of the problems that I'm facing is that this complete lack of communication. We scheduled a meeting for your good selves. It was supposed to be starting around 2 hours ago, and because of that complete blackout of the communication, I could not join you. To the journalist becomes the first and foremost priority. Journalists are people. Journalists are fathers. Journalists are brothers. Journalists are mothers. Journalists are supporting their friends. And trust me, I personally, I've been struggling to live. I've been moving from one area to another. I was asked to move from where I live to another place. Then I was asked to move from that place to another place. So the whole Palestinians and journalists in particular, this is extremely challenging. Survival becomes the first priority. Food, they are not available. You don't know when they're going to hit. You don't know who they're going to hit. You don't know the reason of why they're hitting, but you might end up being targeted by them. Now you see the people walking down the streets. It's like people are going nowhere, uncertain. They're confused. They are in fear because of the ongoing bombardment, and they end up killed even when they're walking, when they're sleeping, when they're trying to secure the food. The situation is there, and when it comes to the journalists, I was today in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, Nasser Medical Complex. I saw the journalists waiting because they don't have any communication whatsoever. They have been struggling to secure whatever connection they can. Me and three other journalists, went to the hospital in the hope that we would find connection. Found internet connection. We went down, we were trying. Now we could not make a connection till a few seconds ago when I could do a connection thanks to one international eSIM that I have. So it's a continuous struggle to live. It's a continuous struggle to survive, and it's a continuous struggle to secure the very basic need of journalists and their families as well. So it's no more a professional duty, so a professional and a humanitarian duty as well. And the journalists are torn apart between their duty towards their families and their duty also toward their career.
So why do you do it, Akram El-Satari? Akram. Well, it looks like we lost Akram El-Satari. We're going to try to get him back on, and we're going to post that interview at democracynow.org. He is a Gaza-based journalist, incredibly brave, very difficult to get this connection, talking to us from Rafah in southern Gaza. We're going to end now with a Barnard professor and student. As we continue to look at what some are calling the Palestine exception to free speech and academic freedom on college campuses across the United States, a New York Times story this past weekend noted, quote, a sustained anti-war protest like the one against the Gaza invasion has not been seen for decades, unquote. But many schools have tried to shut down students and teachers who comment on Gaza or call for a ceasefire. In one of the latest developments, professors at Syracuse University say upper-level administrators surveilled, harassed, and intimidated undergraduates peacefully gathering for a study in support of Palestine earlier this month. So they issued a statement of solidarity and opposition to the repressive climate on U.S. campuses. That's what the letter was called. Signed by more than 900 educators at this point nationwide, and the list is growing. In a minute, we'll be joined by a professor from Barnard College, sister school to Columbia. New York Civil Liberties Union recently sent a letter to the president of Barnard to protest a new policy that requires departments to submit content for their websites for approval by the Office of the Provost. Democracy Now! Spoke with Sophia O'Brien, a Barnard College student and student organizer with Columbia University Chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine.
The most prominent discrimination and harassment on campus has been through not only other students and faculty on campus, but the administration's vilification of Palestinians through these university-wide emails that they've been sending. This is not only vilifying us as student groups that are advocating for an end to the violence as it ensues, but even allowing professors and adults that have very prominent positions in the university to speak so harshly against us and call for harm against students of color that are advocating for Palestine. And with impunity, we have documented hundreds of harassment complaints because the administration hasn't helped us at all with these harassment cases. So
that's Barnard College student Sophia O'Brien, organizer with Columbia University Chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine. For more, we're joined by Pramila Nadasen, a professor of history at Barnard College, also co-director of the Barnard Center for Research on Women and author of the recent book, Care, The Highest Stage of Capitalism. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Nadasen. We just have a minute, then we will do a post-show interview and post it at democracynow.org. But if you can talk about what's happening on campus and why you signed this letter.
What we've seen, Amy, over the past couple of months is a whole series of strategies that universities have deployed, including Barnard College and Columbia University, to censor student and faculty speech and curtail academic freedom. This includes the suspension of Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace on campus, the cancellation of events, the policing of content on departmental websites, as you've mentioned, the presence of NYPD on campus. And this relates back to what you started with, and that is the Palestine exception. What Barnard College has been doing is actually writing new policy as a way to then retroactively decide that events are unauthorized or, in fact, do not follow procedure. And I think there's some really critical issues here. And one of the critical issues is how are decisions at the university made? A lot of these have been made unilaterally without consultation by faculty or students, and is in fact a violation of the university's own conduct guidelines. And clearly there's a tremendous amount of influence by trustees, administrators, alumni, and donors who are making decisions about what kinds of speech ought to take place on college campuses and what can and cannot be posted.
We're talking to Barnard College professor Pramila Nadasen. We want to thank you so much for being with us. We're going to do part two at democracynow.org. Felt it was critical to get in that Gaza journalist. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Indulge yourself in the cultural and folklore traditions of Italy on Il Sole Italiano every Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. Eravamo ancor fanciulli
e ogni sera su quel prato. Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries.
Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.